Hey everybody, thank you for downloading the Leeds Book Club podcast. We're delighted to announce that this week we have a special guest star podding with us, Chris Nixon. A Leeds lad originally, he has recently returned from the States where he's been working as a music journalist and has started writing historical mystery novels set in Leeds in 1731. Anybody who follows the blog will know that I've already reviewed The Broken Token, the first in the Richard Nottingham series, and have just finished Cold, Cruel Winter, the second in the series. Chris has also been kind enough to offer a short story entitled Home, which is available exclusively on the blog. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Niamh.
So I'm hearing in the accent, you've definitely spent some time in the States.
I spent actually more than half my life in the States. I lived there for 30 years.
Whereabouts were you?
The first 10 years I was in Cincinnati in the Midwest, and then the next 20 years I was in Seattle.
So I believe you were a music journalist.
Well, I still am, actually.
Oh, you still do you still do pieces or primarily books
now?
Oh, yeah,
I still do quite a bit, actually, in terms of reviews and interviews and stuff like that, for a number of magazines and websites and what have you. So it's still a big part of what I do, and music remains a huge passion for me.
Yeah, I don't think it ever goes away.
I don't think it does. It's been here since I was 13, and it's showing no sign of abating. So,
but from Seattle back to the UK, that's a bit of a culture shock.
It was. I've been back 6 years now, and I think I'm kind of adjusted.
Yeah.
But still, probably not completely. There are things I'm used to and just things I refuse to do. When I go into a coffee shop, I insist on ordering a mocha, not a mocha. Things like that. So, and I still say banana, not banana. Little things like that.
Yeah, it's the little things. Obviously, you have spent a huge portion of your career as a music journalist, but then since 2010, you've started publishing fictional novels. The two that I'm most familiar with relating to Richard Nottingham. How did you make that move into fiction?
Well, I've always written fiction. I mean, I wrote my first novel when I was 19. It's just that a lot of them have been unpublished, which is probably just as well, to be honest. There was one novel I wrote probably about 2004, 2005, right before I moved back, that was set in Leeds in the 1730s, and Richard Nottingham was a secondary character in that. And I showed that to an agent over here who liked the writing but didn't think the story worked and said, go away and do something else and show it to me. And that's how The Broken Token was born, really.
So you've been living with this guy for quite a while then?
I have, and I mean, I've just completed the fourth book in the series. So he's very familiar to me now, yeah. I'd say.
I think that was something that, I mean, the Broken Token was... It's just so different from anything that I've read before. Obviously, living in Leeds, you know, having it based in the city, I mean, even though it's not the city of today, there are still aspects of it that are really recognisable. And you obviously write about Leeds from a place of total love and affection. I mean, you still seem to be a hometown boy at heart.
Well, I think that where you grow up, it's somewhere you know in your bones. It's somewhere you know better than anywhere else you might live. Mm. I actually lived in Seattle longer than I lived in Leeds. But I know Leeds in a way that I can never quite know Seattle. I mean, my family roots are in Leeds, dating back to right around 1800, in fact. So it's just something I feel and have a very deep sense of and a deep love for, because I realized later that in many ways, Leeds itself is a character in The Broken Token.
Very much so. I mean, it's a secondary character with relation to the action, but it envelops the whole story. Is so it's so influenced by the history of the town and the buildings and the social structures. You know, I mean, it's almost pervasive.
Well, I think it has to be in any historical novel.
Mm.
You have to give people the sense of place and time. And obviously, you know, in Leeds, the geography is very similar. The street layout of the city centre, the real city centre, is very much as it was then.
Yeah.
But there are other things that I think convey a sense of place and particularly of time. Smells and sounds, and I wanted to have people finish the book and feel they'd actually been there and experienced that.
Mm.
I think that's the only way you can really be successful in any kind of historical novel.
One of the beauties of sort of having a physical copy of it was that I traced some of the activity. I like literally walked around the centre of the town because I wanted to see how much of it, you know, you can still find. And it was astounding. The streets have obviously changed, but they're still running almost exactly as you've described them. And, you know, and a lot of the older buildings, or even, you know, even builds that have been remodeled over the years, they're still in the right places, you know, so...
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, there's very little left from the early 18th century. You've got Holy Trinity Church, St. John's Church.
Mm.
I mean, the parish church is in the same location, but it was rebuilt in 1838.
Mm.
You've got Whitelocks, which is in Turk's Head Yard and was the Turk's Head back in those days.
Yeah.
You've got the ship, and that's
pretty much
kind of about it.
Yeah.
But... And that's a shame, and I think actually shame on Leeds for getting rid of so much of its pre-Victorian history, but there's still that sense of things.
Mm.
Well, hopefully there is.
I definitely think that there is. But I think more than that, you managed to capture the fact that although the setting is historic and the way people respond to certain things is defined by the era that they live in, people are still people, you know. I mean, the actions, the responses. I mean, it's quite interesting when people are characters in your book are especially in The Broken Token, I think, because you're setting the scene as much for the series as for the book, but the way that they respond to things like pickpockets and the relationship, I think, between the chief constable and the mayor, it fascinates me because, you know, you see the evidence of that on the television every night when there's something happens and increasingly uncomfortable looking policemen, you know.
Well, it's funnily enough, Richard Nottingham was actually the constable of Leeds at that time. Although I'm sure that the title would have been more or less a sinecure.
Yeah.
And actually, the real Richard Nottingham, his father was the constable before him. But so I've taken some liberties with that, and but the mayor and the coroner, the real names of the mayor and the coroner at the time.
Yeah.
And I'm not even sure why I did that. I think just to give it some bit more historical grounding, and made it seem a little more real. But I mean, to me these days, my Richard Nottingham is completely real.
Yeah.
And I have a huge amount of affection for him, and for John Sedgwick as well.
I've got to say, I think he's actually my favourite character in it. He's so warm. He's just such a warm guy, you know. You could see yourself meeting this fella and really liking him, whereas Richard is, by necessity, a little bit more aloof.
Yeah, it's... They make an interesting pair, I think. I mean, to be honest, with The Broken Token, I wasn't setting the scene for a series. I didn't even think of it as the start of a series when I wrote it. It was just a book. And it was only later when the publisher said, well, what about another? I thought, oh, yeah, well, I guess I can.
Oh, that's really interesting, because I at the moment that I put down The Broken Token, I was thinking, oh, there's going to be more. I mean, it felt like it was the start of their adventures together, if you know what I mean, rather than a standalone.
Yeah, and I mean that's what it's turned out to be. But what I've tried to do with each one is mess with the basic formula of crime fiction a little bit. I mean, the second one, Cold Cruel Winter, which you've read, is not a whodunit at all.
No, it's very structurally very different books.
And that was a deliberate thing. I don't want to write the same thing over and over.
Yeah, avoid the formula.
So I wanted to mess with it and change things around, but also to develop the main characters. That was vitally important to me. My father was a writer, and the main thing I remember him saying is, if you create a strong enough character, people will follow them anywhere.
Yeah.
And that's what I've tried to do. And the personal lives of the main characters, to me, are every bit as important as the plot, the mystery.
Yeah.
And how, you know, how they grow, how they deal with things, how they develop, and even the secondary characters. The Amos Worthy, for example, who's the main villain, if you like.
Oh, I have such affection for him.
Well, strangely enough, so do I. The first scene I ever wrote with him in it, after I finished, I just sat back and I just thought, I've got something here.
Yeah.
And I'm actually toying at some point with the idea of a novel featuring Amos Worthy. And I have a couple of short stories that are about him. One was published in an anthology called Criminal Tendencies, actually before The Broken Token was published, but after it was written.
Yeah.
And there's another story about him that's up on Script, website, so it's there for anybody to read.
Oh, I shall be checking that out.
And of course, you know, the third book in the series is coming out in January.
Is that the Constant Lovers?
It is, yeah.
Yes, yeah.
The fourth one is complete, but the publisher is waiting to see the American reaction to Cold Cruel Winter, which has literally just come out there, before deciding what to do, whether they want to do anything with that.
Yeah.
And personally, I hope they do, because to my mind, it's the best of the books. But
well, fingers crossed. We'll be hearing from you soon that's to be released.
I'm hoping so. It's you know, and I'm. There's still more I want to do with these characters.
Yeah.
Although I will say that the fourth book ends on a real cliffhanger, quite deliberately.
Oh, cruel, man. That's cruel. just to go back to Amos for a moment.
Yeah.
One of the things that I enjoy, I know that he and Richard have a history that goes back to Richard's sort of childhood. But irrespective of that, I think that they have such that there are little idiosyncrasies between the two of them that I just really enjoy. I love that he insists on calling him Laddie the whole time. Were you consciously writing in that sort of very familiar relationship, or did it just sort of develop as the two characters
interact?
It just
developed. I mean, physically, to a small degree, the Amos Worthy in my head is a little reminiscent of one of my grandfathers, who's now quite long dead, whose first name, coincidentally, first name was Amos.
Mm.
So I, there's that connection in there, but his tone is very different, and my grandfather was not a criminal at all. I should probably state that.
Didn't run a brothel, no.
was that Amos Worthy just came fully formed to me.
Mm.
One of those real gifts a writer loves. He just sprang out fully formed, and I made the most of him.
Mm. To my mind, he's a little bit like what the Artful Dodger would be like if he grew up.
I have to say, I don't see that. The relationship between him and Richard Nottingham, to me, is a little bit like the relationship between Ian Rankin's main character and one of the Edinburgh criminal kingpins in the Rebus books.
Yeah.
There's a kind of mutual respect and a mutual hatred, but at the same time there are some similarities between them in, that they may or may not choose to recognize.
Mm.
Enough to create a bond beyond the bond that goes back.
Yeah.
So it's Amos is a very interesting character. And he's there again in the third book.
I was just going to say, I can't wait to see what happens with him.
Although he has a much smaller role in the third book.
I suppose it's necessary as well, because that's one of the things that I really enjoy about your books is that nothing is static. You know, I mean, I was sort of 3 pages into the second book before I realized that that his daughter had passed away. And I mean, it came as an awful shock to me. You don't expect secondary but still sort of primary characters to be killed off screen as well, as it were, you know. The name is just now popped out of my head. You know, the little lad that they had Josh that they had apprenticed. The fact that the idea of him, you know, it being suggested that he'd leave and everything, that again, I was really shocked by that. But I suppose in order to keep it fresh, you need to be constantly, as a city of that side would have been, people come and people go, you know?
Well, it's also a reflection of life. I mean, life was pretty short for a lot of people there, mm. and pretty dangerous. I mean, there were a lot of illnesses around. People succumbed quite easily. It was, you know, largely a young population, and a lot of women died in childbirth. Many children never made it to adulthood, and even where they did, many of them died young. So I'm actually just trying to reflect the time more than anything else. And people, as you say, do come and go, so it's just the nature of life, really.
It is, yeah, definitely. Obviously, you've done quite a lot of research, you know, for the time period and the primary criminal device that's used in the second book, which, by the way, is one of the more unpleasant things that I've ever had inside my head, you know. But that was based
on a real thing. came from a story. Was inspired by a real life news story. Of 2008 maybe, of a book that was found on the street in Leeds and turned into police because it was obviously an old book, quite valuable. And it was when they discovered what the binding was made of that inspired the story. So there is sort of a faint historical base for it, and
it's ghoulish. It's absolutely grotesque. I can't understand why anybody would choose to do it at all.
But as I found out, it was actually relatively commonplace at one point. And obviously, we're not going to say what it was.
I'm trying very hard not to keep it quiet. But
pique people's interest.
Exactly.
But, I mean, I've done a lot of research on the period, and particularly on Leeds in the period.
Mm.
Leeds history, funnily enough, became a fascination of mine. I guess after I lived in Seattle, I would come back about once a year. and generally pick up whatever Leeds history books I could find, just in general. And also eBay was very good for that. I managed to get a couple of wonderful 19th century books, although the postage was horrendous. And I brought all those back with me, so I have a nice little library of Leeds stuff. The Thoresby Society is fantastic for Leeds history. And, you know, they have a wonderful library. So it's, the resources are there, and the interest in the history came before the books, well before. I know I couldn't have set the books anywhere else, because there's nowhere else I know as well. I mean, that said, I'm actually working on two books at the moment, one of which is set in Leeds during the Civil War.
So quite a different time frame, really.
Actually, it turned out that Leeds was occupied by... It was an occupied city, a garrison of Roundhead troops, after the city had been taken and retaken, occupied the city, and all of Yorkshire pretty much belonged to the Roundheads. And I found that interesting, and so there's a mystery, I'm writing a mystery story that's set in Leeds in that period. And there was quite a bit of destruction to the city by Scottish troops. And I just find that very interesting. And the other one is actually set in the music scene in Seattle in the late 80s, right sort of before grunge broke. So for once, I'm actually writing what I know.
I don't think that anybody reading the Richard Nottingham books would think that you don't know the background there. It's they're very well informed books, in all fairness, you know. But obviously, as a child of the 90s, you know, the grunge scene was a huge bone of contention in my family. In fact, my brother is still a Cobain widow, so I'm very excited to hear about that. Is it a fictional again, or?
Oh yeah, it is. It's another mystery, but it's the main character is a music journalist.
Really? What on earth made you think of that?
I don't know what made me consider that. A lot of the main characters are fictional, but the music paper, the guy freelances for, The Rocket, actually existed, and I worked for them for several years, and the locations are quite real, including, you know, the clubs and the coffee shops and the coffee carts. And
it sounds like the sort of thing that if you were there, you'll know exactly what you're talking about.
Oh yeah, I mean, I sent the first 25,000 words out to several readers, some of whom are friends who were there and in the music scene at the time. Some people who know Seattle but weren't involved in music, some who've never been to Seattle, some who know nothing about the music, to get different opinions. And some of the friends of mine who were involved in the music scene at the time just said, thankfully, you've nailed it.
Oh, that's must have been quite a relief to hear as well. But
it's interesting because it requires such a completely different voice.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, the Richard Nottingham books have very much their own voice. I feel like there's a lot of poetry in it.
It's very lyrical.
Yeah, yeah. And quite... I mean, the Civil Fit novel doesn't have that. It's more prosaic and straightforward. But that's the tone that seems to feel right for me.
I suppose it sort of feels right for the time as well.
To a degree, yeah. It's, I don't know why the Richard Nottingham books have that particular tone. It's just what came and what felt right. And So it's become part of the landscape of the books now.
Mm.
I mean, The Constant Love is the third one. Actually takes Richard Nottingham a bit further out of Leeds, in two different directions, one to Horsforth and also to Roundaye. So he's working a bit more out of the city, because of course those were villages that were not part of Leeds at that time. And also a part of it takes place at Kirkstall Abbey.
Oh, I love that place.
I mean, I don't know if you know this, but the after the dissolution and the monastery fell into disrepair, the bottom of the east window, the big east window in the church there, was demolished, and the road to Leeds actually ran right through the nave of Kirkstall Abbey.
I've never read that before. I never come across that before. Gosh, it seems totally disrespectful, irreverent almost to that it was constructed there. I mean, they really wanted the abbey to be redundant, didn't they?
Well, yeah, and they've actually rebuilt the space up to the bottom of the window to that in the 19th century. But I was actually out there a few weeks ago, and I was looking, I was thinking, well, at the entrance to the church, that road must have been damn thin.
Mm-hmm.
But it's something I just found fascinating. And, but the fourth book, the focus is very, very much on the centre of Leeds. I don't think apart from the end, which takes place just over the bridge in Hunslet, I don't think he really goes beyond Briggate at all. It's pretty much all Briggate and the Calls.
Mm.
And that was a very deliberate decision to go from a wider screen to a very tight focus, if you like.
Yeah.
And I've been making notes for the fifth book, and that's going to be very much within Leeds itself. And there's actually a lovely Leeds story I plan on including in it as part of it. It's there used to be an inn called The Crown, which was on Kirkgate. It was almost next to, just up from the parish church. And a recruiting sergeant was in town and got a couple of lads to sign up, got them drunk, and put them to bed in the stables at the inn. Locked them in so they couldn't do a runner during the night. The next morning, he unlocked the stables, and they were gone. And couldn't figure out what had happened to them. But they found out later, when they got to the bottom of the hay, up in the hayloft in the stables, two decomposed bodies. They'd burrowed themselves down in the hay to get themselves warm and suffocated.
Oh, wow.
And to commemorate it, somebody, and no one seems to know who, put a stone, like a brick, in the side of the yard there, with two skulls carved in it.
To represent these two men?
Yeah. And this particular stone disappeared, and it was found many, many years later, built into a factory in Buslingthorpe.
Had quite the history.
I forget exactly where it is now. I mean, for a long time, the yard there was called the Skull and Stones Yard. Because of this particular stone.
Yeah.
But it's just a great story, and it's one of those, you know, you just got to include.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, that must be one of the best things about, you know, being in the position you're in. You get to find out, to track down all of the origins for these weird names and old wives' tales and stuff, and then discover that they actually have quite a basis in fact, you know. Just to talk for a second, I imagine structurally, presumably you get the idea and then you start executing it on page. Which process do you find? I mean, as a professional writer, I'm assuming that the process of writing doesn't fill you with the the fear that it can inspire in the rest of us.
There's always that fear of the first page. I think if I get the first page, or even the first paragraph as I want it, then I'm able to carry on from there.
Yeah.
I know how a book starts. I have a pretty good idea how it ends. Where it goes in between depends on the characters.
Yeah.
All I'm doing is writing down the movie in my head.
It's quite a...
I know it sounds ridiculous, but it's true. I'm just watching what's going on and writing it down. And, I mean, sometimes I know what's going to happen for the next 10, 12 pages.
Mm.
Sometimes I don't even have a clue what's happening next.
And then somebody decides to throw a spanner in the works by heading in the wrong direction or discovering a need.
Strange things do happen. In the second book, where the bad guy starts to self-harm.
Mm.
That just came out of nowhere, and what his girlfriend did after. Again, that was just an absolute shock to me.
Their relationship was very destructive, I suppose, is one of the words. But also, they were very well suited to one another, I think.
Yeah, they were. They were. And, I mean, in a way, there was actually a real romance to their relationship, in a rather twisted way.
Yeah, well, she did wait for years for him.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, but the way they were with each other, and the way he could be with himself, again, that was quite a shock to me.
Mm.
I really hadn't seen that coming at all, and it's just what was happening in my head, and I wrote it down, and
it worked.
I wasn't even sure afterwards whether I'd to keep it or not. So,
but I think it ended up, it really humanized him. In a way that obviously you're too good a writer to have allowed it to happen, but he could have become almost a parody of himself, and he didn't. He remained a very grounded character, off as rocker-like, but, you know, still, it was almost like within his own boundaries. That made complete sense, you know, for...
Yeah, I'm lucky because I have a friend who reads and gives long critiques before these reach a publisher or an editor.
Mm.
And it's a guy I've known for over 25 years now. He's the best writer I know, although he's known as a playwright and a short story writer. He lives in the States.
Mm.
And we basically critique each other's work. And I mean, after I've sent him a novel, he'll make notes, and we'll be on the phone for 2 to 3 hours going through the notes he's made.
Yeah.
And vice versa as well.
Yeah.
So I'm lucky in having that, and he's done a lot to help these books with his suggestions, many of which are small, but they all mount up. And I mean, he was the one who gave the thumbs up to that and said, yeah, it works. Because I have to admit, I was still unsure in myself.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, Cold Cruel Winter is quite deliberately a very dark book. The fourth book in the series is actually, I think, darker still in a slightly different way.
Yeah.
So, and even if you don't realize at the time, I think books of their own accord have a kind of theme. I mean, The Broken Token is very much about family.
Yeah, there's definitely that from start. The fact that he's having those problems with his youngest daughter as well, I mean, it just seems to cement that familial interaction throughout.
Well, families of different types. I mean, there's the family that John Sedgwick puts together with Lizzie, for instance. And Josh, who's this kid who's been sleeping rough, becomes part of the family by becoming a constable's man,
yeah,
if you like. And then there's the family connections between Richard Nottingham and Amos Worthy.
Yeah.
And
but even down to the victims, you know, they're...
Yeah.
The family seems to extend across the board there.
It does, and I mean, again, it wasn't a conscious thing, but I realised later that was the theme, and I mean, the theme in Cold Cruel Winter is very much one of death, in different forms.
Jacob, the poor, throughout the book, he's described as the Jew.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a wonderful character, and then suddenly he's gone, and it's totally senseless.
Mm-hmm.
Especially given the much sort of deeper and more thought out murders that are being committed by the primary antagonist.
Oh yeah, very much so. And I mean, there actually was someone who lived in Leeds at the time who was called Isaac the Jew, and he was the only one, which, given the huge increase in Jewish population during the 19th century, seems kind of strange, really.
Yeah.
And, you know, the third book, Constant Lovers, the theme on that is very much about greed and ambition in different ways. So it's... I suppose, I've grown as a writer as well, and I think more about what I'm doing now.
Mm.
Which doesn't say I plot it out or anything like that, but in the fourth book.
Sorry, I'm going to have to ask you to repeat that a little bit. Our connection went a bit dodgy.
Oh, sure.
You went silent on me. You were just saying that.
Why did you lose me?
The theme was ambition. The theme of the third book was ambition.
And the Constant Lovers, and the fourth one is different again. And there are lots of things I'm trying to explore. I mean, Emily's sort of proto-feminism in the first book, if you like.
Mm.
That comes back later. She said, as a friend of mine said, Emily's got her mojo back.
She was a very defeated character in the second book, having, you know, just lost her sister and her confidant.
I mean, Richard Nottingham, well, the whole Nottingham family is very downcast and trying to put themselves back together, and where do they go after losing their older daughter? And
there's a real tenderness in the sort of, I suppose it's the scene where husband and wife, you know, realize that they're going to come out the other side of that, you know, and he walks to work the next day on cloud nine, you know, and it's for him, it's the simple thing of knowing that they're going to survive, they're going to make it, and I thought all of those interactions between the two of them were so gentle, it was really touching, you know.
Oh, good. That was what I wanted. And I mean, so someone remarked that one of the things that stays with the reader after finishing the books is Richard Nottingham's compassion.
Mm.
And I hope so. I mean, it's, in their own way, these are actually quite political books. I've referred to them before as sort of socialist mysteries.
Yeah.
And they're very, very much about the poor. Now, that was a deliberate choice.
Mm.
It's so many historical novels are about the rich and the powerful and the famous.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to be away from that, because the way ordinary people lived and died interests me a lot more.
Yeah.
Social history. And that's what I wanted to focus on. And hopefully I've succeeded there. It's certainly an aim, one of the big aims of the books all throughout.
Mm. I mean, certainly in terms of the poverty, the weather and the impact that rain and cold and a very long winter has on the poor, that definitely comes across. One of the things in The Broken Token, well, while there are certain interactions with kind of the the better to do. They don't necessarily come across in the most positive light. They all have an agenda. It was it was quite lovely in Cold Cruel Death. There's a character, the widow of the first murder victim, and I thought she was remarkable. She knew exactly who the constable was. She just seemed to be one of those no-nonsense people, but she was also, you know, she wasn't deferential to him, but she respected his who he was and the position that he did. And I thought that you know, where it would have been very easy to have created the caricature of the wealthy, unfeeling class, you know, that's been avoided as well, just by having 4 pages, is it? She only appears
something
twice,
like that, yeah.
You know, but she's very human. I really liked that. I must admit, I would be interested to see, you know, Richard having being forced to deal with his so-called betters. You know, it would be good to see him in that world as well.
There's a lot of that in the third book, actually, where he does most of his dealings are with people who are rich and titled.
Yeah.
And again, you know, that was a deliberate thing I wanted to explore.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's. But again, this is part of changing things around and keeping it interesting that way. And when I reach the stage where I think I might be repeating myself and it's time to stop this series.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, you're doing things outside of it, so I suppose that gives you the necessary gap that it's not like. You know, I know Agatha Christie developed quite a loathing for Hercule Poirot by the end of her
yeah.
writing career. It was one of the reasons she created Miss Marple. She just wanted to move away from the Belgian, you know. But the publishers and the public were so fond of him that that she sort of by necessity had to keep going. But it, you know, she was able to break it up a little bit with some of her other detectives.
Ideally see this series running about 10 books.
Yeah.
And I'm not even going to guarantee Richard Nottingham will be in all of them.
Hmm. I mean, John could certainly take centre stage.
I'm sorry?
John could certainly take centre stage for a book or two, you know.
And eventually he might.
Hmm.
Because, you know, let's face it, they're in a dangerous profession.
Yeah, and he is the heir apparent, you know.
Well, he is. I mean, you know, there's no decisions made on that yet, and but it stands as a possibility.
Mm. I think
an interesting character introduced in the third book, who's an ongoing character, as you'll discover.
Mm.
But it's yeah. I mean, there is a good sort of team, if you like.
Yeah, I would very much agree with that. Given that that there are so many television programs at the moment, I prefer TV as a medium when it comes to literary adaptations, because I think you're able to include an awful lot more of the details. But there's a real historical bent right now, you know, following Rome, we've had the Tudors, and now there's the series with Jeremy Irons, is it the Borgia? Spartacus. I mean, would that be something that you'd be interested in sort of recreating that period on a more on a visual scale?
Well, a very good friend of mine who lives in Leeds and is a playwright has expressed interest in adapting The Broken Token for television as a series.
Yeah.
However, she has been turned down. A proposal's been turned down by a couple of people, so it's kind of in abeyance at the moment. The main thing they've said is it would be very expensive to make.
It would be very expensive to make well, and there's no point in making it unless you're going to get those fine details down, because they are so much a part of the story, the environment, the setting.
Exactly, and I mean, you know, you've got to recreate a town,
yeah.
basically. And that's an expensive proposition.
Yeah.
And I'd be interested in it being adapted for television with the right writer, and she is the right writer, someone I've known for a long time, whose politics are the same as mine, and that's important to me. If I were just to get an offer out of the blue, the only way I'd accept it would be by saying, this person has to be the script writer. Otherwise, no, because it would actually cause me a great problem, because it would give Richard Nottingham, all the main characters, they'd have faces, they'd be physical, and I'd inevitably be influenced by that when I was writing about them in the future.
Yeah, no, I can understand that.
I mean, the nearest analogy I can give you is I was interviewing a few years ago a wonderful Irish fiddler named Martin Hayes, and he said to me, you know, when Irish fiddle playing was first recorded, that changed everything. Before that, you had the tradition that evolved, and people put their own little glosses and personalities into a tune. It changed with each person. Once it was set in concrete on a recording, everybody wanted to imitate the recording.
Yeah.
And I'd be a little worried that I'd be writing to a television Richard Nottingham. That's who I would see in my head. So
I suppose because you're still writing the books, they're still your babies. I mean, you've released them into the world, but they're still very much yours. After the series is over, I suppose it would be easier to, you know, to sort of watch the show as a separate, you know, a separate thing. But while it's ongoing, I imagine it. Having said that, I think Philip Bannister would be a great Amos Worthy.
I'm sorry?
I think the guy from Life on Mars, I could see him being Amos Worthy.
I'm not sure I can see that, I have to admit. It's, but, yeah, to a degree I can see your point.
Yeah.
It's,
but I suppose that's the beauty, sure, I get to speculate.
He's the only one where I can really see a face.
Yeah.
Richard Nottingham and John Sedgwick might be very, very much there and very present to me, but they don't really have faces.
I suppose you're looking at the story through their eyes.
To a large degree, that's it, yeah.
I believe earlier when we first started, you said that your family date in Leeds back to that time. Is there any chance that they're going to pop up at some point?
No. I mean, I managed to go back to 1795. An ancestor of mine was born in Malton, in North Yorkshire.
Yes.
But that's... And he moved down to Leeds in the early 1800s. But that's... So my connection comes a lot later.
Right. I suppose that's a, that's fair enough. If you're still writing them in 50...
My mother's family... Just, their family name was Townend. And the back in the period I'm talking about, the area of Brigid, sort of beyond the Hedra where New Brigid is, was called Townend. If there's a connection there, I don't know. There may be.
I'm actually working with a lady whose surname is Townend, so it's she's very, very Leeds. So it's obviously it's one of those names that has survived the passage of time, you know.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And
I mean. You know, my last name is as best I can tell, a very Yorkshire name. So
yeah.
It's, but Leeds is just absolutely and utterly, you know, in my blood. When I come up and walk around Leeds, what I'm seeing is not the Leeds of Harvey Nichols and,
Pound World.
Marks and Spencers and what have you. What I'm seeing is Leeds as it was, and just up Brigid from Kirgit is the Moot Hall standing right in the middle of the street, and the Shambles with all the butcher's shops on the ground floor, and the Market Cross up at the Hedrow, and things like that. It's like existing in two different times at once.
Mm. Are there, at the moment...
I'd probably get treatment throughout the NHS, but...
Well, as long as you don't expect a preference for living in the time frame you can't actually get to, I think you should be okay. Is The Broken Token and Cold Cruel Winter, are they available as ebooks yet?
Broken Token is. Mm. In fact, it's really only available as an ebook now because Grindelwald Crime, which published that, was a small independent publisher, and Lynn, who was the publisher, actually sold the imprint to Seven House.
Mm.
So although Cold Cruel Winter is published by Seven House, at the moment it's just out as a hardback. It's coming out as a trade paperback in January, right around the time that The Constant Lovers is published.
Mm.
And I don't know, I haven't heard any plans to put it out as an ebook. I wouldn't be too surprised if it came out as an ebook not long after trade paper, but don't quote me because I've not heard anything about that.
Right. Well, Chris, I'm going to have to bring this to a close, but it's been such a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you very much. I'm flattered that you wanted to, and it's been a lovely conversation.
No, you're going to be my first podcast interview. So
I'd just like to say thank you again so much, and look forward to chatting to you soon about your next book.